The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. In Tobias Wolff's short story, The Room, the narrator, a farmhand for the summer, making 10 cents an hour over minimum wage, remarks of his job that it set you free among strangers in the eventful world, where you could practice being someone else until you were someone else. That's a tactic that Wolff, one of our great contemporary masters of the short story, practices with delicate skill in his fiction. Wolff, the storyteller, allows us insight into what his narrator names as the actuality of a life we know nothing about, or, as Wolff says, making life where there was none. Wolff is best known for his two dazzling memoirs, This Boy's Life, the story of his precarious childhood in a small Pacific Northwest town, and In Pharaoh's Army, about his reluctant stint as an officer in the Special Forces in Vietnam. After his stint in the Army, Wolff attended Oxford, then returned to the States where he worked variously as a reporter, this is a great list, a night watchman, a waiter, and a high school teacher before receiving a Wallace Stegner Fellowship in Creative Writing at Stanford University in 75. He's currently the Ward W. and Priscilla B. Woods Professor in the Humanities at Stanford. He's also the author of the short novel The Barracks Thief, three collections of stories, In the Garden of the North American Martyrs, Back in the World, and The Night in Question, and most recently the novel Old School. He's also edited several anthologies. His work is translated widely, and he's received numerous awards, including the Penn Faulkner Award, the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, the Penn Malamud Award, and the Academy Award in Literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. His most recently published work, which he'll be discussing tonight with David L. Ulan, is a collection of new and selected stories titled Our Story Begins, which combines 10 spare and elegant new stories along with 21 stories from Wolff's three previous collections. These crisp, urgent dramas remind us why Raymond Carver once wrote of Wolff's stories, not one doesn't in some way speak to the human condition. David L. Ulan, who will be in conversation with Tobias Wolff tonight, is book editor of the Los Angeles Times. He may be a little bit tired since this was the Los Angeles Times Festival, so if he nods off, no, he's raring to go back there. He is the author of The Myth of Solid Ground, Earthquakes, Prediction, and the Fault Line Between Reason and Faith, and the editor of Another City, Writing from Los Angeles, and Writing Los Angeles, a Literary Anthology, which won a California Book Award. He's written for many publications, including The Atlantic Monthly, The Nation, and The New York Times Book Review. He's a great advocate for literature and authors here in Los Angeles and across the country. We're very pleased to have him here tonight. Two of David's interviews for Aloud with British novelist Will Self and with translator Robert Alter are now available as Aloud podcast. So if you haven't explored the Aloud podcast page, you can go to our website and click on podcasts, and they will keep coming there. We're adding more all the time, so please do take advantage of this, and you can carry Aloud with you as you do your walk or your run or your, not a swim yet, unless you have one of those special iPods. But anyway, it is a great honor, great pleasure to welcome Tobias Wolff and David L. Ulan to the Los Angeles Public Library. Please join me in welcoming them. Thank you.
We promised Louise we'd go off like powder kegs. So we'll try. We're going to talk for about 45, 50 minutes, and at some point in the middle of that conversation, there will be a brief reading, and then we're going to turn it over to you guys for a few questions here and there. But we're going to just start with the questions. I have to say I'm a little nervous to be sitting across the table from a writer who wrote the story Bullet in the Brain, which revolves around a book critic getting a bullet in the brain. But take our chances. Is there any message we should take from that?
Oh, nothing personal.
Okay. I want to talk about our story begins first and then sort of move into some other areas. Among other things, it's a new and selected, so it's a career retrospective in part, not entirely. And I'm curious about what it's like for you as a writer to start thinking in terms of a career retrospective, in terms of looking at three books of stories and looking at 25, 30 years of writing and culling out the stuff you want to preserve. What was that process? How did that come about in the first place, and what was that process like? Is it bittersweet, or is it exciting, or what is that?
Well, the bitterest part was leaving out stories. And it came about, I had a new collection that I'd been working on for some years, and as I was reading through it, I was about to send it off. In fact, three or four of the stories didn't seem quite as strong to me as they first had, and I thought, oh, well, this is going to take a little longer, and I was preparing a couple of stories for an English anthology from previous collections, and
like an omnibus of your own work.
Exactly right. No, not an omnibus collection of my own work. They were four anthologies of American short stories, and I began to see or feel certain connections between those stories and some that I had been working on, and somehow or other, the idea grew in me that maybe this would be a good time to put some of these new stories, the best of the new stories, together with the best of my previous stories. It sounded easier to me than it turned out to be, like most plans. And so I went back through them, and it was really hard letting a lot of those stories go. And I'm, to this day, not exactly sure why I did it. Again and again, for example, after I'd handed the book in, I got this really sweet note from Joyce Carol Oates telling me, you know, I just wanted you to know that every fall when I start teaching my creative writing students at Princeton, I read the story Sister to them, and it always it's always such a wonderful way to start the semester. That was one I'd left out. someone just came. I gave a reading at Kepler's bookstore in Menlo Park the other night, and a high school teacher came up to me and said, you know, I just wanted you to know that that I teach a creative writing class in Palo Alto High School, and I always read them, your story, Coming Attractions, and he said there's always a moment of silence after I finish, and I'm thinking, oh, if you look in the table of contents, you're not going to be happy because that story's not in there. And indeed, even the title of this book is taken from a story that was in my second book that I decided not to use, but I liked the title, and it kind of embraces the stories nicely, and so you know, I know I will give pain to a couple of people who particularly like that story. So, you know, and I like them all. I wouldn't have put them in. I've written many more stories than I've included in my collections. I've only put stories in my collections at all that I've thought well of. So it was hard. It was a question of finding, some of the stories, for example, might seem to hedge too closely into territory of another story. Mm-hmm. I would be able, I think, to justify the differences, but nevertheless, I wanted that sense of variety and at the same time kind of harmonic continuities in the
right, because you're putting together, I mean, but whatever else you're doing, you're putting together a book that
exactly
has to hang together
a single
as a book, right?
That's right. It's not a complete stories. That would be a different kind of book, and that also for me has a somewhat funereal tone to it. So I wanted to avoid that, and
right.
you know, William Trevor. Not, you know, some 20 years ago, I think, did a new and selected. Alice Munro,
right.
Some 10 years ago, did a new and selected. And so that's something that one might do along the way with the hope that more stories would be forthcoming and that you're not kind of putting the stone on your own head. But
so then did you start in some way with the new stories? Since you had those new stories, you knew you were going to use that block of new material,
right?
That sort of created the basic theme of the book, and then you went through the old stories looking for pieces that kind of fit in that general architecture?
Yes, and I was very, I mean, for whatever writers will say later, short story writers, about what guides their choice, say, of ordering stories and that sort of thing, you really are proceeding by instinct. And then later on, which is the way you write also, and then later on you, you know, you come up with reasons for doing why you do what you did. And then the reader will completely frustrate all of your work, say, in ordering a collection by, you know, doing what I do, which is you, well, for example, if I'm reading William Trevor. William Trevor, though, in his 80s, is still got a beef with his school days. And he still resents something that happened to him in his school days. And he always has a school story in which he, once again, is trying to get revenge for those years in every collection. And those, all, I love his school story. So I always go straight, no matter where it is in the collection, I go straight to the school story. And all readers do that kind of thing. Or if it's late at night, they'll read a shorter piece. They're not going to take on the novella in the collection, right?
Right. Now, you talk in the preface, in the introduction of the collection, that you know you were faced with another choice, which was, do I keep the old stories as is, or do I go through and comb out some of the things that, whatever they are, some of the things that were the rough spots, let's call them, or what you perceive as the rough spots. And in the end, you decided to go and do that.
Right.
You know, T.C. Boyle, when he did his big collected or half career, whatever it was, decided to go the opposite, make the opposite choice because he was going to, you know, have the stories, they existed as they existed in that moment. I was curious about what the process of that decision was. Being a lazy writer myself, I would have probably just left them alone because they were done. So I'm kind of, I respect the impulse to go back in and work on them. And I'm wondering, A, how much work did you do on some of them? And B, what was the impulse? Was that, did you know that right from the start, or was that something that in the process of putting the book together evolved as a kind of strategy?
The only thing that I wrestled over in that is whether to tell the reader that I did it. and I was prevailed on by a couple of friends who said it would be dishonest not to say that I had done that. And the fact even that two other people would know I'd been dishonest compelled me then to make this little note at the beginning. In fact, in my own case, there is no original kind of virginal text of any of these stories. When I write a story, I put it through several drafts. So let's say the story that I finally send off to a journal, which is the first step in publishing my work, would represent some weeks or months, even in some cases, of work and many drafts. So there's no, right away, there's no text. And then I collaborate with the editor of the journal, who, you know, she might have some really good suggestions that will help me get closer to the story I really wanted to write. Maybe some of the suggestions I won't take, but some I will. So that changes it. Then it goes into, so then it's published. Then I send it off to my hardcover publisher, and I have a very good editor there, and he makes some good suggestions. Some I don't take, some I do. So right away, it's changed again. It changes again if a story has been accepted for an anthology. Then I just go, the editors of anthologies don't do editing, but I do again. I look at it again and say, what can I do to make this story even better, to bring it closer to my dream of what it can be, to give it its fullest expression of life? And generally speaking, for me, this involves cutting. Very little has been added, though some things here and there I've added a few sentences to bring out something that I felt I had left too implicit. But to go on, then there's the paperback publication. I go through it again, and then subsequent editions. We're going to do a new edition in England of your work. Would you like to look at them again? I always do. So, you know, there is no original version of these stories to leave alone.
Right.
They're just, it doesn't exist. And so these stories are, to the extent that they're alive, they're, I mean, all things that are alive, the thing they have in common is that they change. And so I'm making sure that these stay alive by continuing to change them. And these changes, as I say, are mostly what other people might think of as cosmetic, but story writers would not consider cosmetic. Isaac Babel once said that no iron can pierce the heart with the force of a well-placed period. And that's a wonderful respect for punctuation he had, but some might think excessive. But that's the kind of scrutiny that you can feel in his stories when you read them. And you read Red Cavalry or, the Odessa stories. They have that kind of concentration and care. And that's the aspiration, I think, of every short story writer.
Do you find the perspective? I mean, I'm curious about the perspective, particularly, say, even in putting this book together, of looking back at a story 20, 25 years later. In many ways, it's like looking at a story that someone else has written, because or do you not feel that? Are you still close to the writing experience over that period of time, or is it really a matter of sort of almost editing someone else's work?
I know that in some ways the person I was 30 years ago was a different person, but when I enter the work again, I don't feel that. I still feel as if I have a stake in these stories and that they're even now still deeply connected. And for that reason, you know, if I really did think they were that different, if I was really on a completely different enterprise then than I am now, I would really leave them alone. But I have to say that I don't change the actions of the story. I don't change, you know, the events. I don't change the characters' natures or their names or anything like that. It's all, most of this is, almost all of it, 90% of it is in the language.
Right. And then the last question on sort of the structure of it, which fascinates me, is that when Raymond Carver did Where I'm Calling From, which was also a New and Selected, in England or Canada, not in the United States, the news stories were pulled out and published as a standalone book called Elephant, which was just those seven. I guess there were seven news stories. Is that something that you would consider or ever did consider for the ten news stories here? Or is it just really the sense that those 10 stories together, although they may hang together as a thing, are just not big enough to be a book?
I suppose they could be a book. I mean, The Europeans are much more comfortable with these thin little books than we are, and they're willing to pay for them. And for some reason or other, we're not. Even as it is, one of my sons think that I kind of stretch. He says that when he picks up a book of mine, he always feels like he's about to open a book of poetry because the margins are so wide and there's so much space between the lines. Actually, I like that format because it's more welcoming I don't like seeing lines just packed 500 to a page, and you know, it's just it's a forbidding kind of look to it.
Right, there's nothing scarier than opening up a book and seeing just dense text.
Looks like homework.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, white space on a page is
right.
Big margins and white space is the key factor. You've written short stories all the way through. I mean, your first two books were books of short stories. In some ways, you could call, I would consider The Barracks Thief to be sort of, it's a novella, but a long, it operates both as either a short novel or a long, long short story. And then you've also written two book-length memoirs and a novel. And I'm curious about, staying on the short story side for a moment, what makes a good short story as opposed to a good longer piece of work? What do you think, for you as a reader even, or as a teacher, as a thinker, as a writer, what is the essence of a good short story?
Honestly, I couldn't say. I wish I could. But you know, if I read, for example, Tolstoy stories, a story like The Death of Ivan Illich, well, that begins almost with his birth and does quite literally go to his death. And so that's a story written almost on the pattern of a novel. And yet I love it, and it's a story. It's a story. And it has, perhaps it's a story because of its concentration on the kind of fatality to the soul of basing your entire existence on what is acceptable to other people and what other people regard as de rigueur or comme il faut, as to use those French phrases that Tolstoy uses continually in the story. So it has that concentration of theme, a relentlessness of theme with a great sprawl of time. Chekhov, more characteristically, would have, would be a glimpse more of somebody's life passing right in front of your eyes with wherever they were over here not shown and wherever they were over there not shown, but giving you enough of the arc of their lives that somehow imaginatively you are compelled to draw that circle yourself, that circle that Tolstoy draws entirely for you. My own art, my own practice as a storyteller, though occasionally I lean more toward the Tolstoyan mode. Most of the time, I find what I really love about the challenge of writing a story is the possibilities of it as an art of implication, and as such, it is the literary form that seems to me to most deeply express trust in the reader. It's the deepest communion with the reader of which I'm capable as the short story, because I continually ask myself, were I reading this story, would I need to be told this? Or would I be able to kind of pick this up out of the atmosphere? Would I be able to intuit this? And if I think I could intuit it, I leave it out. And that's kind of the process of revision that I did here, too. I kept asking myself that question. Can I trust a reader as I would trust myself to get this? And so that's the kind of, and that's where the short story really takes on a kind of gravity and a deep rootedness that is, that what's there isn't always visible, as Hemingway liked to say, but it's there. And the reader should, you're just trusting the reader to feel that. It's so much an art of implication in that way. And that's a great challenge to the writer, but it's also what keeps it interesting for you as a writer as well.
Right. I mean, I think, I mean, this is a high compliment, that your stories make a reader work, but in the best way, where the reader has to be kind of waist deep in it and engaged. There's not, you can't just sit back and let the story happen.
Right.
But I'm curious.
I don't want to explain myself badly here. I don't think that good stories are puzzles. I don't think that's the point of it. I think as a mature reader encounters a story, a good short story, you aren't required to approach it as work in the sense of that which is disagreeable and must be forensically decided and adjudicated and parsed out and left the parts all over the dissecting table. And that's not for me what good writing should demand of the reader. But let's take, for example, a story like Joyce's story, Two Gallants in Dubliners, these two guys who meet on the street one day. One's a police inspector's son who has a bit of money and has a dirty trick he's about to play on a serving girl. And his friend Lenahan, who has no money and is the kind of guy who hangs around at the outskirts of the bar hoping someone will buy him around. And so they meet up and they hatch this rather mean little scheme, and then they split up for the day. And may be tempted to judge them, Lenahan, pretty harshly by what you've seen. And then he's on his own for a few hours, and he's very hungry. And he goes, he has almost no money. And he goes into this little shop, not one could hardly call it a restaurant. And he sits down, and all he has money for is a plate of peas. And Joyce just watches him in the story eat this plate of peas. And through that action, you understand so much about this man and his life. And it's just an extraordinary moment, and how deep that moment goes in your understanding that he just lingers on that for a moment. The trust, again, that Joyce has in us to understand something from watching a man eat a plate of peas.
So it's an art of silence and listening in some way. I mean, the reader has to listen, but I think the writer is also listening to that reader. The thing that interests me, or that I want to ask you about, is that is, in your mind, somehow different, say, not that the other writing isn't that, but it's less intense, or it's intense in a different way in terms of a long-form piece of writing, or, say, a memoir. It's not an art of implication in the same way? Is that...
Not quite so much, no. I don't think so. I didn't feel that that deep unspoken weight so much in the when I was writing the memoirs as I do in the short story. But I, again, I mean, I can certainly I can think of novels. You know what somebody once said about a novel, that it's about the novel form, that it's a prose narrative of a certain length that has something wrong with it, and that can be seen and obviously and really. Whoever said that, I think maybe it was Swift, had I think the longer novels of his time in mind. I can think of perfect novels though. Marguerite Duras, The Lover, William Maxwell's So Long, See You Tomorrow, probably Gatsby, in fact, All Quiet on the Western Front. I mean, they tend to be short, though. Yeah. They do tend to be short, those novels. But Moby Dick, which is a great novel, truly a great novel, and I love that novel, but it's also a bad novel. It's, I mean, you know, he forgets. This is not how you conduct a novel, that you forget 100 pages into it, that you're actually, your narrator isn't you, it's a character. And then you go on in your own voice for about 70 pages and think, oh my God, yeah, Ishmael's supposed to be telling this story. And then you go back to Ishmael, and that's how the novel is. And yet, you know, it is so powerful and reaching, and the language is so extraordinary, and so many indelible moments in it, that it is still a great novel, but it's a very badly conducted piece of work.
One of the things I really like about your stories is that they do have, or many of them have, an open-ended quality. I'm thinking about, for instance, The Other Miller, which is collected in here, which you think is about one thing, and I'm going to be vague because I don't want to give it away to people who haven't read it. You think it's about one thing, and then it has this sort of long conjectural riff at the end where all of a sudden the entire story opens up and could in fact be about something, about the opposite, about something completely different. And it's a really interesting reading experience in a fairly concise space to have both of those possibilities, one liberatory and one not, balanced together, and not to see the second one until it emerges there. And I've now explain the story in a way that
really
is completely incomprehensible.
I think that's sufficiently obscure.
Right? So no one,
someone reading this
don't want to ruin the plot. But I mean, I'm curious about that as a kind of idea and a strategy. And again, you know, for a lot of people in a space that short, in a narrative space that short, you think there aren't going to be loose ends or there can't be that kind of openness. I think that openness is a really wonderful thing in a story. And I'm curious about sort of how you develop that.
Well, to take a, I mean, you know that. That famous story that they had us all read where we're kids, the lady or the tiger, right? Where, you know, what's it going to be? It is that in The Other Miller, there isn't that, you know, there isn't a trick of plot really in that way. But what it is, that other possibility is actually the dawning in the main character's mind, Miller's mind, of there being another possibility than the one he had previously
right.
taken for granted, and that shakes him to his core, and gives rise to that ending. And so that it marks a shift in consciousness of the main character, and then is reflected, of course, in the story itself. And again, I trust the reader to understand, you know, to understand that, and then to in some way, you know, be able to see Miller beyond the limits of the story itself and be able to kind of follow him out of the story,
right.
You know, farther on.
Another thing I like as well are there are a number of stories in both in the book and in your other books that are almost stories built out of incident. They're stories where the drama or the dramatic moment is either glancing or a little outside what we might expect. One such story, I think, is That Room, which we can segue directly into asking you to read that story, and then we can talk a little bit about what it implies.
This is a pretty short story. I think the shortest in the new stories. It's called That Room. It's one of the few first-person stories in this new gathering, That Room. The summer after my first year of high school, I got a case of independence and started hitchhiking to farms up and down the valley for day work, picking berries and mucking out stalls. Then I found a place where the farmer paid me 10 cents an hour over minimum wage, and his plump, childless wife fed me lunch and fussed over me while I ate, so I stayed on there until school started. While shoveling shit or hacking weeds out of a drainage ditch, I'd sometimes stop to gaze out toward the far fields, where the hands, as the farmer called them, were bucking bales of hay into a wagon, stacking them to teetering heights. Now and then a bark of laughter reached me, a tag end of conversation. The farmer hadn't let me work in the hay because I was too small, but I beefed up over the winter, and the following summer he let me join the crew. So I was a hand. A hand. I went a little crazy with that word, with the pleasure of applying it to myself. Having a job like this changed everything. It delivered you from the reach of your parents, from the caustic scrutiny of your friends. It set you free among strangers in the eventful world where you could practice being someone else until you were someone else. It put money in your pocket and allowed you to believe that your other life, your inessential, parenthetical life at home and school, was just a sop to those deluded enough to imagine you still needed them. There were three others working the fields with me. The farmer's shy, muscle-bound nephew, Clemson, who was in my class at school, but to whom I condescended because he was just an inexperienced kid. And two Mexican brothers, Miguel and Eduardo. Miguel, short and stolid and solitary, spoke very little English, but rakish Eduardo did the talking for both of them. While the rest of us did the heavy work, Eduardo provided advice about girls and told stories in which he featured as a trickster and deft, indefatigable swordsman. He played it for laughs, but in the very materials of his storytelling, the dance halls and bars, the bumbling border guards, the clod-brained farmers and their insatiable wives, the larcenous cops, the whores who loved him, I felt the actuality of a life I knew nothing about, yet somehow contrived to want for myself, a real life in a real world. While Eduardo talked, Miguel labored silently beside us, now and then grunting with the weight of a bale, his acne-scarred face flushed with heat, narrow eyes narrowed even tighter against the sun. Clemson and I sprinted and flagged, laughing at Eduardo's stories, goading him with questions. Miguel never flagged and never laughed. He sometimes watched his brother with what appeared to be mild curiosity. That was all. The farmer, who owned a big spread with a lot of hay to bring in, should have hired more hands. He had only the four of us, and there was always the danger of rain. He was a relaxed, amiable man, but as the season wore on, he grew anxious and began to push us harder and keep us longer. During the last week or so, I spent the nights with Clemson's family just down the road so I could get to the farm with the others at sunup and work until dusk. The bales were heavy with dew when we started bringing them in. The air in the loft turned steamy from fermentation, and Eduardo warned the farmer that the hay might combust, but he held us to his schedule. Limping, sunburned, covered with scratches, I could hardly get out of bed in the morning. But although I griped with Clemson and Eduardo, I was secretly glad to take my place beside them, to work as if I had no choice. Eduardo's car broke down toward the end of the week, and Clemson started driving him and Miguel to and from the decrepit motel where they lived with other seasonal workers. Sometimes, pulling up to their door, we'd all just sit there, saying nothing. We were that tired. Then one night, Eduardo asked us in for a drink. Clemson, being a good boy, tried to beg off, but I got out with Miguel and Eduardo, knowing he wouldn't leave me. Come on, Clem, I said, don't be a homo. He looked at me, then turned the engine off. That room, Jesus. The brothers had done their best, making their beds, keeping their clothes neatly folded in open suitcases. But you got swamped by the smell of mildew the moment you stepped inside. The floor was mushy underfoot and shedding squares of drab linoleum. The ceiling bowed and stained. The overhead light didn't quite reach the corners. Behind the mildew was another unsettling smell. Clemson was a fastidious guy and writhed in distress as I made a show of being right at home. We poured rye into our empty stomachs and listened to Eduardo, and before long, we were all drunk. Someone came to the door and spoke to Eduardo in Spanish, and he went outside and didn't come back. Miguel and I kept drinking. Clemson was half asleep, his chin declining slowly toward his chest and snapping up again. Then Miguel looked at me. He slitted his eyes and looked at me hard, without blinking, and began to protest an injustice done him by our boss, or maybe another boss. I could barely understand his English, and he kept breaking into Spanish, which I didn't understand at all. But he was angry. I understood that much. At some point, he went across the room and came back and put a pistol on the table right in front of him. A revolver, long barrel, most of the bluing worn off. Miguel stared at me over the pistol and resumed his complaint entirely in Spanish. He was looking at me, but I knew he was seeing someone else. I had rarely heard him speak before. Now the words poured out in an aggrieved sing-song, and I saw that his own voice was lashing him on somehow, the very sound of his indignation proving that he had been wronged, feeding his rage, making him hate whoever he thought I was. I was too afraid to speak. All I could do was smile. That room. Once you enter it, you never really leave. You can forget you're there. You can go on as if you hold the reins, that the course of your life, yea, even its length, will reflect the force of your character and the wisdom of your judgments. And then you hit an icy patch on a turn one sunny March day, and the wheel in your hands becomes a joke, and you no more than a spectator to your own dreamy slide toward the verge, and then you remember where you are. Or you board a bus with 30 other young men. It's early, just before dawn. That's when the buses always leave, their lights dimmed, to avoid the attention of the Quakers outside the gate. But it doesn't work, and they're waiting, silently holding up their signs, looking at you not with reproach, but with sadness and sympathy, as the bus drives past them and on toward the airfield and the plane that will take you where you would not go. And at this moment, you know exactly what your desires count for, and your plans, and all your strength of body and will. Then you know where you are, as you will know where you are when those you love die before their time, the time you had planned for them, for yourself with them. And when your daily allowance of words and dreams is withheld from you, and when your daughter drives the car straight into a tree, and if she walks away without a scratch, you still feel that dark ceiling close overhead and know where you are. And what can you do but what you did back in this awful room, with Miguel hating you for nothing and a pistol ready to hand? Smile and hope for a change of subject. It came this time. Clemson bolted up from his chair, bent forward, and puked all over the table. Miguel stopped talking. He stared at Clemson as if he'd never seen him before. And when Clemson began retching again, Miguel jumped up and grabbed him by the shirt and pushed him toward the door. I took over and helped Clemson outside while Miguel looked on, shrieking his disgust. Disgust! Now he was the fastidious one. Revulsion had trumped rage, had trumped even hatred. Oh, how sweetly I tended Clemson that night. I thought he'd saved my life, and maybe he had. The farmer's barn burned to the ground that winter. When I heard about it, I said, didn't I tell him? I did. I told that stupid sumbitch not to put up wet hay. Thank you.
Thanks for reading that. Okay, so this is a great story. And for me, the reason why it's a great story is because it's short, but it takes its time. It explodes. It's the powder keg. But it takes a while to explode. It sets up. It develops. It takes its time. And then the explosion is the non-explosion. Nothing really happened. I mean, in terms of actual physical danger, there's a risk. There's the revolver. But there's not even a confrontation because the confrontation gets diffused by Clem getting sick, but yet it opens up this whole lifetime series of understanding exactly where you are, that you're always in that room. So all these things are going on in the space of, what, 4 or 5 pages. It really is that kind of the lack of obvious drama and the kind of subtlety of emotional drama. So I wanted to just ask, I don't really have a question except to ask you kind of what the draw of that is, or how that evolves out of these, out of the material. How does a story like that develop?
Well, not all my stories arise from memories. This one does. I did, in fact, work in the hay with a couple of brothers rather like these, and this did occur with the pistol. And I didn't know what to make of it at the time, and that's why at the end of the story I returned to the completely callow, immature voice of this young man who, you know, appropriates Eduardo's wisdom about fermenting hay and claims that wisdom for himself. But there's no question at all that the terror I felt that night moved me into an apprehension of my own mortality that I had never had before. Right. I knew that I was actually in danger of being killed because he was not seeing me. He was not seeing me. He was seeing this. And also, may I say, at the same time, an apprehension of a history behind him and his brother that was very sad and unjust and tragic. I felt it. I couldn't have reasoned it out in those terms, but that somehow or other, that history was erupting in a moment, and I might have thought I had nothing to do with it, but I was there, and I was in its way, and I knew that. And so just beyond the fact, and this of course comes over time, all these other thoughts, but you know, just beyond the fact of my own mortality that I felt was also the play of these tragic histories in the world against which you might that might run across your path at any given moment, and that we are all somehow imperiled by that. That's the later thoughts that came to me in writing this. But the essential moment of entering a psychological atmosphere that I've never really left of apprehension, of knowledge of mortality and of the fragility of the people I love, that kind of thing, really, I think, probably proceeded from that moment and other moments later like that, refined it. So that was the germ of the story. But then, you know, there's certainly, you know, elaborations that would never allow me, in my own mind anyway, to call it a memoir. It's not really a memoir.
Well, it's interesting. I want to use that as a segue into some questions about memoir, because you've written two really profoundly beautiful memoirs that do deal with your own life directly, obviously, hence the term memoir, unless you're Margaret B. Jones. But
or any number of other
any
writers.
Any number of others. But I'm curious about, sort of to follow up on what you said, what makes a piece of experience memoir, or what makes it a piece of, or what makes it a piece of fiction? I mean, obviously, not all of your fiction, or even most of your fiction, is directly autobiographical. But what, what's the difference in the impetus there? The memoirs, to me, also are not memoir. There, it's not storytelling of reclamation as much as it is storytelling of testimony. All the stuff you're talking about, that fragility, the sense that history is history and is unfixable. I mean, there's a great quote in one of the stories in here, in The Mature Student, where a professor says that, you know, you Americans have this sense that you can go back and make up for the past, but the past is locked in. That's it. You can't reclaim it, and you can't do anything about it. That seems to infuse the memoirs as a sensibility also. So how does the memoirs and the fiction kind of fit together, and how do they, and what makes them separate?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good question, and from time to time, people have asked me about various stories I've written. Well, why didn't you put that story in the memoir? And because there are sufficient similarities between the story, perhaps the tone, some of the characters to suggest that it's memoir rather than story. And my answer is, when that happens, is because this didn't happen. And I understand that when you've written a couple of memoirs, that you are tempting the reader in some ways to read stories that seem to hit that same tone and that have people like that in them to read it autobiographically. I don't really mind doing that. I don't really mind tempting the reader to take my work autobiographically, as long as I'm honest about it. If it says short stories on the cover, caveat emptor. I mean, you know, when you read that and it says story, but you want to take it as fiction, I mean, as memoir, that's all right with me. I haven't been dishonest. And the same with this novel, Old School, which has a narrator whose inner life is rather like mine, and some of whose biographical details chime, though actually he's a couple of years older than I am, and he's been a school that, though like the one I went to, is not the one I went to, that sort of thing. The fiction writer, but it does say novel on the cover, and readers really have to pay attention to that. William Maxwell, I mentioned his book, his novel, So Long, See You Tomorrow. When you look at the author's note on that book, it really corresponds precisely to the details about himself that the narrator reveals in that book. But again, you really have to beware to take that as memoir because in fact he made up a lot of it. And as a subsequent rereading, if you read the novel closely, you'll see it is really a novel. And I really bring that intention to my fiction. When I'm writing a memoir, I do understand that memory is, memory is, well, we were talking out in this green room here before we came out about, you know, going back and talking about things you've gone through with your relatives, with your brother in your case, at your parents' 50th. And you started talking about the past, and you got two different versions of the same events, right? That's just two. I mean, imagine sitting at a table at Thanksgiving with 15 people and getting them all. And that's inevitably the way memory works, because just to take the most brutally obvious thing about memory, when you look back on these memories of yours, there's an odd little thing that they will all have in common, and that is that you are the leading actor in them. But it will perhaps not surprise you to be reminded that you are not the leading actor in anyone else's memories. In fact, you might just have a walk-on where you thought you were the lead. And
also, you're not just the leading actor, you're the protagonist as opposed to the antagonist.
Exactly, right. Exactly. And that's right. And the oppressed instead of the oppressor, and we could go on. You know, just that character.
That's all totally true.
Exactly. So there's that, and then there's just the very mechanism by which we instinctively make stories out of the past. There's this editing going on below the level of our consciousness all the time that is turning our experience into memory and the narrative of memory, and in most of our cases. And to make narrative out of experience means leaving almost everything out and highlighting a few things having to do with you, and seeing other people in a certain way, hearing the way they talked in a certain way. All you know, when you recall it, and then he said, and then I said, well, you know, if there'd been a tape recorder hovering in the air at that moment, it might not exactly record that thing that you remember so vividly. But that's all right. That's fair. That's fair, I think, within the bounds of memoir. What is not fair is to deliberately blur that line, to make things up, and to know you're making them up, and to call it memoir. Why do that? Why not just call it what it is, which is fiction? And fiction is a noble, I mean, you know, the imagination is, I think, in some ways, even more reliable an instrument of truth-seeking than the memory is. Why not call it fiction? Fiction is a noble enterprise, and I do think sometimes people may try to get some extra purchase on the attention of a potential reader by calling something memoir rather than fiction, and to gain, if you will, a kind of advantage that way that maybe the work itself doesn't really merit. I think there's been a bit of a pattern of that, but.
I have a couple of questions about this before we go to the audience. One is, do you think that whether by virtue of the rise of the memoir, the rise of reality television or confessional television or whatever we want to call it, a culture of confession that we seem to live in now, that we've lost in some way? I mean, I think it's interesting that you don't mind if people read your fiction as autobiographical, whether it is or not. But do you think that we've lost the ability to recognize that fiction is fiction, that just because the narrator is a first-person narrator or the incidents are close, as in Maxwell's case, or take Frederick Exley or Henry Miller, who wrote novels in which their main characters had their names.
Even had their names. And Tim O'Brien does
this. Tim O'Brien also, yes.
And Tim O'Brien in The Atomic Age, he talks about his daughters. He didn't have any kids then.
Right.
And he's really playing, but the word novel is on the
right,
cover. And Exley also the same thing. He didn't have the offspring that he describes having in A Fan's Notes.
Right.
I mean, the one accurate sentence in there is when he talks about this long malaise, my life, what a character, but they're definitely playing with it, but in fairness, it does say novel on the cover. And, you know, I think it is the prerogative of the fiction writer who is confessing to writing fiction to use any device to bring the reader with full credulity into her world or his world, as long as you've been up front about what you're writing, and then anything is fair after that. It doesn't work on the other side, though, with the nonfiction.
Right, I totally agree. I guess the question I'm getting is, I think that with all of this line blurring, I think we as a culture sort of, on the one hand, lost the sense that fiction is fiction in some sense, no matter how true it seems, and also that memoir is, as you say, is an imaginative recreation, so that we ought to be reading, or hopefully are reading memoir, not for a factual point-by-point account of a life or a series of incidents, but to get at the emotional inner life of that experience. That it's literature. It's not reportage, generally speaking.
Yeah, the best. But I will. But I'll just go back again on one thing. I think where memoir legitimately the blurring is in your reading of events, mm-hmm. and your sense of what another person is like, or what something meant, or what the atmosphere of an occasion was. But I would be very disappointed if somebody said to me, "This thing that you said happened did not happen."
Right, right.
That I don't allow myself. I mean, the events that I put all this atmosphere and interpretations and the characters around events, they are my personal take, but things happened or they did not happen. And to say, you know, for example, you were in prison when you weren't in prison, that's not allowed.
Right.
That's fiction then.
Yes, I agree with that.
Right.
So as a closing question, though, do you have any, is there a different obligation? I'm sure there is, but maybe not. Is there a different obligation to your characters in a memoir or fiction? I mean, I think most writers have an ethical obligation to their characters one way or the other. But when you're writing memoir, you know, in this boy's life, your mother is an actual living person. Dwight was an actual living person. Do you have a different obligation to those people, as well as his characters, and where's that line for you?
That's a really interesting question, and I think, you know, one of the things that has, I think, been troublesome to people I've known who've been working on these is the inevitable loss of privacy, not only to themselves but to the people they're writing about, and I have had a couple of friends who were so scrupulous in that regard that they finally could not write the memoir. They finally decided. One of them had one guy from the South that I knew had an amazing memoir going. He grew up in a house where his father was a self-made man, and from quite rude beginnings, and then made himself actually quite a business empire, and married into a kind of patrician family in Savannah. And then subsequently created for himself a myth of his own kind of aristocratic lineage, and this BS was handed out to all the kids, and it was a house where both the parents were alcoholics, and it was a house of lies, really. And it had the predictable consequences, which is that the kids all, you know, had trouble and were looking for something genuine in all the wrong places for a long time. And this guy wrote this stunning opening chapter about something his father had done in interfering in his life that just took my breath away. But he finally gave it up. He said, you know, I can't do it. He said, they're liars and drunks and frauds, but they're my parents, and I really love them. And I just can't do this to them. And I really respected him for that. Yeah. I really respected him for that. I would have done it. But, because if I had allowed myself to be held hostage by the tenderness of other people's feelings, I would not have been able to tell a story that I really needed to tell, or I would have exploded, you know, and he didn't explode. He didn't, I guess, need, as I did, to tell his story in quite the same way. But I really honor people who have that kind of tenderness about right, other right. people.
But in the end, it's the story. If the story is that has to come out, the story has to come out.
Yeah,
right?
It does. Right. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, David.
I really appreciate this conversation. So we have a microphone there. If you guys want to raise your hands, we'll call on you. The microphone will come around, and then you can ask your questions. So, the woman in red.
Hello. I've been reading The Night in Question again for a second time, third time, fourth time, I'm not even sure. And I started really seeing things in each story that I hadn't given much thought to previously, which is the themes that were so apparent. And from one story to the next, the theme of who's lucky, who's not lucky, redemption, guilt, you know, et cetera. And I started wondering, for the short stories that are not autobiographically based that you just were discussing, where do you start with these other stories? Do you start with what if this person met that person? What if this person sent in their own obituary, for instance? Or does it start with a character? Let's see where they're going to lead, which I kind of suspect not, but I don't really know for sure.
How do stories happen, in other words?
For you.
I don't know. I honestly don't know how they happen. And if I knew, I could command them. And I can't. And one of the things that every writer discovers after a while is how given your work is to you. And there are periods when it is not given to me. And then I know. And I am grateful. And for that reason, I think, you know, most writers at some point or another become very wary of talking about their work. It's superstitious, to be sure, but, you know, you live on the grace of mysteries, really, and the mystery of the gift that is given or withheld. And, I mean, I can say, well, a story started by my hearing a bar of music that, or a line of music that took me back to a time that that suddenly illuminated another shelf full of ideas. And in retrospect, that is the reason I would give. But where it wells up inside of one, in those still moments when suddenly something comes to you, I haven't the slightest idea how that happens. And some writers, I was on a panel yesterday with Jane Smiley and Ron Carlson, and we were and Susan Salter Reynolds, and you know, we were talking about Trollope, and you know, here's a guy, I mean, through whom the river was always running, enviably, and you know, he wrote by quota of words each day, and if he finished a novel before his quota of words had been reached that day, do you think he got up and popped that bucket of champagne his wife had on ice for him? No. He sat there and started the next novel. That moment from that period until he had fulfilled, and he wrote, you know, they don't read like they were written on an assembly line. They read, they're living thing. I mean, you know, the Barchester Chronicles, they're fantastic. Phineas Finn, especially The Way We Live Now. These are great novels, and yet they were written that way, and it's just so unfair. But there it is. It doesn't come that easy to me.
It was 10,000 words a week, right?
Was that what it was?
I believe he cranked out 10,000 words a week. Yeah.
Oh, please.
I know. That's a good couple of months. In the back, the far back.
Hi. Sorry if I have my facts wrong, but it seemed to me that the story you read was originally published in The New Yorker as a memoir or nonfiction, and I was wondering.
Well, yes, it was. That's exactly right. It was originally published as a memorial piece in The New Yorker some years ago, not that many years ago, and then I brought invention to it. I changed it. I added elements of imagination and foreknowledge, I changed its nature, really, and it became a fiction then. But it grew out, this more than any other story in the new collection, really grew out of memory.
So what made you decide to turn that story into fiction? What is it specifically that makes it fiction? Because it seems like the events and the
names. I thought I had left out the very thing that made it interesting to me to begin with, in which is the whole question of that walking or that movement from one psychological state into another, and the way you read events in life from that moment on. And it seemed to me to belong much more in the realm of fiction than in the realm of nonfiction there.
Okay. Did you ever find out what Manuel was so angry about?
No. No. And it was as if it had never happened. We went on working together, and he was the same, and I pretended to be the same.
Thank you. Can you speak a little bit about having things or adapting them yourself for film? Having fiction? Film adaptation of fiction or memoir.
Mm-hmm. I haven't had a lot of experience with that. I've had one of my books, This Boy's Life, made into a movie. And, you know, most people really seem to like the movie. And so I judge that a success. And, you know, I would certainly do it again. It sent my kids to college. Really, no small thing. And so I'm grateful. I I think I was not able to love the movie myself because I was so jealous of the material because it was memoir. If it had been a novel, I knew they were going to change things. They had to change things. They were making it into a movie. But, you know, as a writer, I definitely got a kind of a course in the meaning of words that as a writer I should not have needed. For example, the meaning of the word rights. And the understanding that when you have sold your rights, you don't have them anymore. And so, you know, my attempts to tell the filmmakers how this film should be made were met with polite nods, and there it ended. But other people have. Michael Keaton is working on a script about one of my stories right now that he wants to direct, and these young filmmakers, James Strauss and Galt Niederhofer, who made this beautiful movie, which just disappeared without a trace last year with John Cusack, called Grace Is Gone. It won the Audience Award at Sundance. What happened to it? It just vanished, and it is so beautiful. I urge you to rent it from Netflix, because you can get it on Netflix now. It's a great, beautiful, moving film with John Cusack. I think it's right up there with High Fidelity and Say Anything and these great roles that he's done. And Grifters, but the most emotionally charged performance that he's ever given, and a couple of child actors who will just take your breath away. It's a beautiful movie. And the people who made that are working on my last book, Old School, and maybe something will come of it. Most of the time, nothing does. That's all right.
Right over there in the back.
When I read a memoir, I often picture the author writing it. I don't do that with fiction for some reason. But in your case, I'm curious, are there one or two places where you classically write, or do you just write wherever you find yourself?
I wrote This Boy's Life in the attic of a house in Syracuse. I wrote all of it there. I'm not able to write out of my habitat, and Pharaoh's Army was written in the attic of another house in Syracuse, and my last book was since I came to Stanford. I like to work away from home now, and they offered me a carrel, a little kind of study office on the fifth floor of the library at Stanford, looking out over the Stanford Hills, just beautiful. I couldn't write at all. It was so beautiful. And so I asked them if they had a room in the basement. And, and they did. They had some carrels in the basement, windowless, lit by overhead buzzing fluorescent bulbs, no pictures on the walls. The only books I have in there are reference books, dictionaries of slang, that kind of thing. And I write very happily there because there's, I really, if I could take, a computer into an isolation tank, I would work there. But this is the closest I can get to it. I really have to kind of cut myself off when I write. I will take any temptation to, to distract myself.
We have time for one more question. The gentleman in the front. The front, right? The front of the... The front of the back, yes, thank you.
As you work to shuffle older stories with newer stories, did you notice any different insights between the younger person and the older person that you are?
It isn't so much a question of the insights being different as of their texture changing, I think. They're more nuanced, more tolerance for ambiguity, and more touched by family concerns than the stories of the younger writer were, though they're there also. You know, the writer, though, is really not the best judge of those things because it's such an interior experience of the work that you're having all the time. It's hard to see it from outside. I think another reader would probably be a much better judge of that than I would be. Well, thank you for your attention tonight. Thank you, Jason.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.